A local proposal to cut funding for the Athens-Clark County Police Department has been floated. We'll dive into the details and talk about a similar program in Oregon.
Because we don't show up six deep with guns out, people are willing to engage with us in ways they would not with the police.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Also today, could a post-Memorial Day spike in coronavirus cases be on the horizon?
I think anytime, again, we see people traveling and moving, what they're doing is unwittingly taking the virus with them.
And the Clark County School District wrestles with its budget amidst economic uncertainty.
If these budget cuts are passed as they were suggested, every district will have to decide for themselves where to find the revenue or what cuts to make.
Those stories, our panel on the Week in News and more, coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Monrovia, Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Athens-Clark County will have a new sheriff next year. ACCPD officer John Q. Williams has defeated longtime incumbent sheriff Ira Edwards. He joins us now to discuss his victory. So first of all, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Tell me what changes you would like to see at the sheriff's office.
So I want to make sure that the safety levels are brought up. So we got to make sure we don't just have deputies who only get a few days worth of training and then they're tossed out there by themselves to work in the jail. That's going to help everybody be safer in the jail and then on the road. And I also want to implement policies that allow for deputies not to just be in the jail. It's a stressful environment and they should be able to do other tasks. We also have the courthouse they could do there. I would like to implement some more patrol responsibilities. Currently, the police department do most of the 911 calls, any actual police enforcement acts. So I want our deputies to be able to get out there and do things. That can make a difference and that can, you know, extend your career.
And what would you say to deputies that you may be supervising if you are elected in November? What would you say to them? You want to implement changes that can be a little uncomfortable for people.
My first mission is going to be to talk to everybody in that sheriff's office. But then I also want to hear what their ideas are. What do they see are the problems? What do they see are the good things about working and being a member of the sheriff's office? And we want to enhance those good things and we want to fix those things that are not so good. And one way to do that is going to be by just forming this advisory panel of members throughout the sheriff's office so they can have a voice in how the sheriff's office is run. And I think it just brings up morale across the board. And that's a big problem from what I hear currently at the sheriff's office is morale. I think those types of changes are what people want.
Can you tell me your reaction to protests here in Athens and around the nation and the world? As a law enforcement officer and an African-American male, you have a unique perspective on this.
I understand. Clearly, the point where the protesters come from, and I absolutely support any person, their right to assemble and their right to express their concerns. I agree. There are some incidents that have happened that give law enforcement a black eye, but I'm the first to tell you that police officers, we don't want the bad cops around any more than the general public does. So I think it's good that we bring attention to the issues that matter. And then the next step is, okay, how do we fix it? And have that criminal justice reform that a lot of people were talking about. So I think where I differ from some is I don't think that we need to tear the whole legal system down. I think we do need to reform. And I think we can fix law enforcement in this country.
John Q. Williams has defeated Clark County Sheriff Ira Edwards and is running as a Democrat on the ballot this November. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a tumultuous past couple of weeks, but an unfortunate constant has been the coronavirus pandemic. As mass protests have taken place across the country, including in Athens, health experts have expressed concerns about a potential increase in coronavirus transmission. Here to talk about that and to give us a local pandemic update is Dr. Grace Bagwell Adams, an associate professor in the University of Georgia's College of Public Health. Dr. Bagwell Adams, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just start out. Obviously, we're in a period of great social unrest, and people have been taking to the streets to address those concerns through protests. But how safe is protesting during a pandemic?
That's a really good question. It is not something that we can guarantee is 100% safe, of course. The way that this virus transmits is through, as we know, respiratory droplets, and protests often involve shouting. And so anytime you're getting in a large group of people, you're exposing yourself to risk of contracting the virus, and that risk is exponentially greater than it would be, for example, like going to the grocery store.
Well, before we had people gathering in streets for protests, we saw crowds of people gathering on beaches for Memorial Day weekend. That's just about 2 weeks ago. Might that result in a spike in new cases in the coming weeks?
Absolutely. I think anytime, again, we see people traveling and moving, what they're doing is unwittingly taking the virus with them. So I think the thing that now we must think about doing is just making testing a part of preventive health. So if you know you're going to travel, or if you know you've just come back, being a good steward of your own health, your family's health, your community's health is getting tested and self-isolating until you get the results.
And so then when we look at the protests that have been going on, when might that spike occur?
Well, that's a really good question. Right now, the test results from the Department of Public Health, you know, it's a few days before you get those results back, but then those results have to get reported to the Department of Public Health from the clinician. And so that takes time. And so we will likely see the effect of these large gatherings, I think, in 14 days or so, if not sooner.
Well, it's recommended that everyone who's been out protesting get tested for the virus just in case. But what's the status of testing? Is it easier to get a COVID test now than it was, say, in April or May?
It's much easier to get a COVID test now than it was in March. What I've heard anecdotally, locally, is that our rapid testing sites at Clark Middle School, for example, have been inundated with people wanting to get a test. Prior to Memorial Day, my understanding was that those testing sites were actually not being used very often. I don't recall hearing anyone talk about lines or long wait periods in the month of May. But since Memorial Day and then the protesting, I have heard anecdotal reports, at least, of people waiting up to 6 or 7 hours in order to get a test at that one site.
How has our local healthcare infrastructure been holding up? Do you think Athens hospitals can handle these surges on the way?
So one of the best resources that I've seen is if you look on Facebook, the Georgia Emergency Management Association daily puts out a count of hospital beds that are available by region in the state. Right now, we are not at a point where we are in a surge. There are critical care beds available, there are emergency room beds available, and there are regular inpatient beds available. So right now, hospital capacity looks pretty good.
Good. Well, finally, do you have any advice for our listeners on how to keep staying safe in the ongoing pandemic, especially if they're getting out to protest, for instance?
It's a great question. Those First Amendment rights are really important, and I completely respect people's individual decisions to participate in these protests, but I just want to encourage people to stay safe. And again, getting people to mentally switch to thinking about getting tested for COVID as a regular part of their preventive health routine until we have other options, and just building a couple of days into your schedule with work or other family responsibilities so that you can self-isolate until you get your results.
Grace Bagwell Adams is an associate professor in the UGA College of Public Health and an investigator for the Athens Well-Being Project. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Chris.
Athens Clark County Commissioner Jerry Neesmith died last weekend after suffering a fall at his home. He was elected to the Athens Clark County Commission in 2012, and his time as a commissioner is remembered fondly by his colleagues.
More than anything, he was just a good guy, just an all-around decent, kind, smart human being, and a very pragmatic legislator.
That was Melissa Link, District 3 Commissioner.
You know, he's a bridge builder. He, you know, more than anything, wanted to bring people together to find common ground, to do what was best for the community as a whole. I don't think he had any enemies. I mean, there were people who he might have disagreed with or disagreed with him, but he really, really saw the good in everybody.
Neesmith also served as an unofficial liaison between the commission and Athens Airport Authority. Mike Matthews, airport director for Athens-Benepps Airport, reflected on Neesmith's efforts to bring commercial air service back to Athens.
So we had his full support on that. He was on our committee. He had some really great ideas as far as marketing goes. And you could just see the passion in his eyes when we talked about the future of the airport and the potential growth of the airport. It was evident he was very interested.
Neesmith was also a member of the board of directors for Advantage Behavioral Health Systems and a fierce advocate for mental health services in the community. David Sweat was also on the board.
And he was particularly attuned to the needs of individuals that come into contact with the criminal justice system because of the possibility of severe and persistent mental illness or some kind of a co-occurring substance abuse disorder. And he was supportive of Advantage creating a 24-hour walk-in facility. And he was supportive of Athens-Clarke County Police Department and the solicitor developing a pre-arrest diversion program that would prevent people who needed treatment winding up in our jail.
Commissioner Jerry Neesmith was 71. This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News.
I'm Tim Franks. From the biggest breaking stories of the day to the important issues and trends, we're there.
This is an historic victory and what is a very important day.
This could change world history.
Everybody's going to pay a price. He will, everybody will.
And I am just so happy to be home and to put my feet on this land again.
Another huge development.
Join me and my colleagues for NewsHour from the BBC.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley. Joining me now to discuss the week in news and politics are Blake Odd from Flagpole Magazine, Lee Shearer from the Athens Banner-Herald, and Gwen O'Looney from WXAG. It's good to have the original panel back again. Gwen, nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So we obviously have to start with the election, which I wanted to know if there are any races at either the local or state level that surprised anyone.
Well, the most surprising to me on the local level was the defeat of Ira Edwards, our incumbent sheriff, by John Q. Williams. I was very surprised at that, although I shouldn't have been. But he was defeated, I think, for a lot of different reasons. He gathered a lot of money from bail people, from property owners that need evictions, from jails and prison industry contractors, which is new. But I was surprised very much by that one.
I think I was surprised by that too. Anyone else, or did you guys see this coming?
Yeah, I don't think any of the other results necessarily were surprising. You know, I mean, you would generally expect the incumbents to win and three really of the incumbent commissioners won. I was a little bit surprised by how much they won by. The lack of in-person campaigning, I think, probably hurt the challengers because they're just sort of less well-known and have more of a need to kind of get out there and knock on doors and get their name out there. And they didn't have that opportunity, probably has something to do with it. One interesting thing I noticed is that when the absentee ballots came in, they were much more for the incumbents generally than the people who voted in person. So I really think there was a shift. People have been casting absentee ballots for weeks. And so there was a big shift in these commission races in between the people who had already voted and the people who voted on Tuesday. And I'm wondering if that had something to do with all the protests over the past week or so, really kind of turning sentiment against, you know, the status quo or the incumbents or something like that.
It's an interesting point.
Blake, you mentioned the absentee ballots, and I looked back with Charlotte Sosby, our head of the Board of Elections, and in the presidential primary in 2016, we had 404 absentee ballots mailed in. And in this primary, we had almost 15,000. That is a huge, I think COVID may change the way people look at absentee balloting.
You may be right. Yeah. I mean, especially with all of the lines and everything that were reported in other parts of the state. I mean, everything seemed to go smoothly here, but, you know, you read all these stories about Atlanta, Fulton County, DeKalb County, Chatham County, having to keep their polls open late because people were having to wait hours and hours to vote. You know, and that seeps into people's consciousness, even though that isn't happening here. And so I do think that a lot of people might see that and say, you know what, I mean, it might just be a better idea to vote by mail from now on.
Well, you know, I think Georgia once again won the race for incompetent and poorly run statewide elections. And everybody's beating up Brad Raffensperger, but he inherited a mess. And he inherited closed down precincts. 10% of our polling places weren't open.
Well, and that's on the counties. I'm not going to say that, you know, Brad Raffensperger is doing a bang up job or that there aren't any problems at the state level. But when you look at polling places being closed, not having enough poll workers, things like that, you know, that's on the county because the counties really run these elections. And
well, the poll workers are not on the county. The poll workers are on COVID.
The counties are the ones who hire them is what I'm trying to say. So, and Fulton County has been, I mean, every year, every election, you know, it doesn't matter who the Secretary of State is, Fulton County is going to be 2 hours behind everybody else.
I hope that we can learn some lessons about what went wrong this time, because I would expect to see many more people voting in person in November.
So the Secretary of State sort of shifted the blame to local officials, county elections officials, poll workers, et cetera, not being adequately trained. He kind of shifted the blame onto them. Maybe there's some merit there, but do you think overall the buck stops with him or no, with the local offices?
I mean, there's plenty.
I think the local offices have a lot to account for. That's right. There's a lot to go around.
Right.
And the question now is, are we going to learn from this and fix the problems that we know what the problems are now?
Right. Well, I agree with Michael Thurman. The buck stops at the top when you get down to it.
While we're blaming everybody, let's praise our local folks.
Yes.
A little bit. They did such a bang-up job, as they always have done.
I agree. I totally agree.
And speaking of learning something, they obviously did learn something, because 2 years ago, it was a disaster. You know, there were hours long lines everywhere. They were totally unprepared for the kind of turnout that we had.
Right.
You know, they messed up counting some absentee ballots.
That's right.
There were a whole lot of question marks about the 2018 election, and, you know, 2020, you know, they managed to, you know, you talked about the 400 absentees in 2016, and they miscounted over 100 of them and had to go back and do it over again. And this time they managed 15,000 absentee ballots and got them all processed.
Yeah.
You know, it took them 20 hours, but they did it. So, yeah, I think they did a great job, and it was in and out for everybody. I heard, you know, the longest I heard anybody had to wait was 15 minutes.
Right.
So, I mean, they did learn whatever lessons they needed to learn from 2 years ago.
You guys, there was a huge turnout, I thought, for a primary election, especially with the presidential nominations basically already decided. What do you think drove the turnout?
It was really easy to vote with the absentee ballots. Every active voter got mailed an application.
And when they went out, you know, the presidential primary was not over yet. So I do think that probably drove turnout to a certain extent, at least as far as absentees go.
So moving on to something I guess, in a different form of the political arena. That is the rally and protests we had in Athens. What did you guys think about those? What are your thoughts?
I was at both of those demonstrations, and they were very different in a couple of ways. The police were, I think, pretty much frightened the first time, and they unleashed tear gas on the crowd to get them to go home. And I think our police chief may have gotten some bad, scary information from federal or state authorities about a boogaloo invasion with all these boogeymen coming in with guns and going to start trouble and so forth. And then the next weekend, it was just a very different crowd, much larger to begin with. And the thing that stands out to me about that most is they picked up litter after themselves.
Yes. The second weekend really showed, I think, the kind of town that Athens is. And I think the police chief got the message that we were not a tear gassing town. One of the things I thought was so tacky was Brian Kemp coming over here, not telling anybody he was coming, but coming in with all the National Guard heavies, and then, you know, requesting the police chief to leave his post and come to the operations center to talk to the governor. Kemp taking the pictures. I mean, it was just, to me, it was so selfish and political in a time when we didn't need that kind of interruption or distraction.
Yeah, that was just a photo op. Right. You know, and there had to be at least 500 cops, maybe more, around downtown. I mean, you know, between local cops, National Guard, Georgia State Patrol, they even had that park police.
It cost a lot of money.
Overtime.
It cost tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars, you know, between the helicopters and all the overtime, you know, and the gas for all these big, I wouldn't be surprised if it was six figures, but it was such overkill, you know, and it clearly did nothing to quell any hint of violence, because people were so on edge because of this huge police presence, snipers on rooftops, you know. I mean, I think it really, and thankfully nothing happened. I mean, you know, at the end of the night, like, it just broke out into a dance party, pretty much. It's not because of the heavy law enforcement presence. It was in spite of it.
Yes.
Because it really made people nervous and uncomfortable, and I think it made violence actually more likely.
I do, too. I think they escalate things when they act as if there's going to be a riot. You know, it's just like your children. If you expect them to be bad, sometimes they live up to your expectations.
Well, we're going to leave it there for this week. I do want to thank my guests, Lee Shearer from the Athens Banner-Herald, Blake Odd from Flagpole Magazine, and Gwen O'Looney from WXAG.
Some things you don't really have to question. If you want to believe the dog in that viral video was cooking spaghetti, you go for it. But how your decisions this November will affect your community, that is worth really thinking about. On your NPR station, you get reporting that informs your decisions and challenges what you think you know, because some things are worth that extra mental energy. 2020 election, it's time to listen.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. A rallying cry that emerged out of both local and nationwide protests over police brutality was a call for city governments to, quote, defund the police, end quote. But what does that mean exactly? It's more about divesting than disbanding, cutting funds from police budgets and allocating that money into other areas of the community like youth education or mental health services.
We talk about defunding the police as a mechanism of funding other types of programming and community crisis response that address a wider variety of crises that exist in our community with a more specialized form of response and stop crime from happening in the first place by making sure everyone has what they need to thrive.
That's District 2 Commissioner Mariah Parker, who has developed a concrete plan of action to address the demands of constituents to re-envision what public safety looks like in Athens. Along with District 5 Commissioner Tim Denson, Parker has proposed a plan to transition 50% of armed officer positions in the county to forms of nonviolent response like mental health professionals, social workers, and restorative justice mediators over the next 10 years. Parker and Denson are also calling for other measures like adding a mental health team within the police department, making 5 current vacancies in the department permanent, and increasing public defender salaries. The plan has already received support from the ACLU of Georgia, which sent a letter to the mayor and commission stating it is, quote, the best and most serious effort, end quote, of tackling police violence in the state. Though bold, the commissioner's plan is not far-fetched. In fact, it was inspired by actions taken by other communities across the country to address these issues, like crisis intervention units in Salt Lake City and Houston.
So there's like models all across the country of mental health co-responders where they go out with police officers to help de-escalate emotionally distressed individuals, as well as social work patrollers that correspond with officers to help people access resources they need to avoid getting into crime or recidivism.
The program that had the strongest influence on Parker was the CAHOOTS response team in Eugene, Oregon. It's a 24-hour mobilized crisis intervention team that contracts with the city's police department to field all calls related to a mental health crisis situation. That's roughly 17% of their call volume. They deal with a range of social services from dispute intervention to basic first aid. There's no weapons, no uniforms, no police escort. Here's Manning Walker, a medic and crisis worker with the CAHOOTS program.
We can often engage with people who are hostile with the police without any risk to ourselves whatsoever. Because we're not armed, because we don't have the ability to hold people against their will, because we don't have the ability to arrest people, because we don't show up 6 deep with guns out, people are willing to engage with us in ways they would not with the police. They're willing to be vulnerable. They're willing to sit down. They're willing to be heard if we're willing to listen.
CAHOOTS costs the Eugene Police Department around 5% of their annual budget per year, $1.9 million this fiscal year. And Walker says that the investment pays off. It frees up capacity in the police department, promotes nonviolent response, and does not deter individuals with mental illnesses from pursuing help.
Investment in social services pays vast dividends in the long term. Cost savings from unnecessary hospitalizations, unnecessary police injuries that can be reallocated into community paramedicine, ongoing mental health counseling, those things generate cost savings year after year that can be further reinvested in the community, save lives, and build the community economically over time as well.
There were 6 reported officer-involved shootings in Athens-Clarke County in 2019. Mental health was a factor in most of those officer-involved shootings, and across Georgia, the statistics are just as bleak. There were 47 fatalities from officer-involved shootings in 2019 alone.
A lot of attention gets put on issues across the country, but in Athens alone, we had fatal police shootings last year. And so to ensure that never happens again in our own town, what can we do to re-envision what public safety looks like for Athens?
Parker and Denson's recommendations are up for a vote at the Mayor and Commission's 2021 budget meeting on June 16th.
Georgia lawmakers are expected to return to the Capitol next week after a months-long hiatus due to the COVID-19 pandemic. At the top of their to-do list is the state's budget. And that's an even bigger deal than usual this year, not only because of the uncertain economy, but also because local governments and school districts are facing a tight deadline for their budgets. Savannah Ciccarella reports.
This time last year, the Clark County School District prepared their yearly budget with a good idea of the amount of state funds they would receive through the Quality Basic Education Act, or QBE. That's the formula that decides how much state money is going to K-12 public schools in Georgia. Around 80 to 90% of that amount goes toward teacher salaries and benefits. This year, however, with the state legislature out of session until June 15th, the district will have to factor in a proposed number of state funds into their 2021 budget to meet their June 25th deadline. And with Governor Brian Kemp's proposed 14% cut to all state agencies, that number is looking much lower than it did last year.
It's about an $11 million loss in revenue if it is 14%. You know, we're fortunate that our tax digest has showed continued growth in Athens-Clarke County. We're looking at over a 7% increase. So that our property tax increase is roughly around $7 million for the year.
That's Chris Greiner, the CFO of the Clarke County School District. What he's saying is that the increase in property taxes, which is one of several revenue streams that finance public schools, could be used to offset the projected loss in state funding, along with federal CARES Act funds. That's a good thing. The district is not changing its millage rate, so it's bringing in an additional $7 million from property tax growth during 2021. But if that state cut is higher than the proposed 14%, the district will be in trouble.
I mean, the best way I can put it is that every district is going to have to decide for themselves. If these budget cuts are passed as they were suggested, every district will have to decide for themselves where to find the revenue or what cuts to make.
That's Stephen Owens, a senior education policy analyst at the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. Now, what can these cuts look like? That's cuts to enrichment programs, less custodial staff and school bus drivers, furlough days, and larger class sizes. Owen says that the proposed state cut is not unlike the strict austerity cuts made in the wake of the Great Recession, where the state lost billions of dollars in revenue for 4 years in a row. The effects of that are still seen in school districts today, like increased class sizes and a shrinking school staff.
We learned in the Great Recession that there are absolutely consequences to that. This is not just kind of theoretical cutting the fat. This is the firing of teachers. This is less enrichment opportunities for kids. This is, you know, something that we can feel in our communities every single day as our kids are in larger class sizes.
There is a silver lining to the district's tentative budget. They did not budget for increased class sizes or furlough days, and so far, they are firm in their decision to keep it that way. But they might have to change that if there is an increase to that proposed cut. Here's Greiner again.
It gives room, as we've told the board, they've prepared well for situations like this, which is exactly why I think sometimes when people say, why do you have so much in fund balance, this is exactly why. You know, you hope you never have another pandemic, but it is why you have a fund balance.
Another silver lining comes from the expenditure side. The county has budgeted for increased salaries for custodial staff to raise competition in the market. The county also budgeted for pre-K and paraprofessional salary increases, according to Chief Human Resources Officer Lynn Duke.
The pre-K is not so much a competitive for the market because pre-K is not paid to scale in the entire state of Georgia. All of the pre-K teachers and the paras are paid below scale. So we wanted to treat our pre-K folks right and pay them and make up the difference that the state was not funding.
For now, the district is at the mercy of the state. The district adopted its tentative budget on May 21st and plans to finalize it by June 25th, 5 days before the state submits its final balanced budget. The rough goal is just to get a good idea of that percentage cut before June 25th.
I think we feel comfortable where it's at now. We're using a portion of fund balance. You know, the board feels comfortable with that. I think as it stands now, if we could do 14 or less, we would be comfortable.
For Athens News Matters, I'm Savannah Sicarella.
One change brought on by the pandemic is in how religious services are conducted, primarily online, at least in the past few months, and the move away from in-person worship might be affecting people's relationship with their faith, WUGA's Gene Davis reports.
A Pew Research poll released in April revealed that for a quarter of Americans, their religious faith has grown stronger because of the pandemic. But as much as the faithful may wish they could congregate right now, most people understand that it's still not safe to worship in the way that they're used to. Rituals, once taken for granted, carry the potential for viral transmission, so the leadership at places of worship have had to adapt to the times. Often this comes in the form of religious services being streamed online, either live or pre-recorded, which Ellen Richardson, a retired priest who attends St. Gregory's Episcopal Church, described.
It lacks a lot. I don't think all the needs that people try to meet by going to worship in a congregation can be met online.
And as our internal clocks may have had trouble calibrating as March dragged on and then April slipped into May and June, the liturgical calendar has kept the same beat it always has, making for strange and often lonely Easters, Passovers, and Ramadans. Amina Abbas is a community organizer at Al Huda Islamic Center who has been attending the mosque her entire life.
We decided to have this drive-through iftar, which iftar is the meal to break your fast at sunset. So we would have catered meals for the community where they would be able to come and drive through and send the greetings of peace to everyone and at least be able to see some familiar faces while they're coming to pick up their food. We did the same thing for Eid as well. And Eid is the celebration for the end of Ramadan. We gave candy to the kids and toys, and we decorated the outside of the mosque, and some families also decided to sort of get out of the car and safely take pictures so they can remember this pandemic Eid.
For Abbas, it was a difficult Ramadan, but it also provided her with more opportunities for reflection, one of the main purposes of the month-long holiday.
We always sort of say that Ramadan is like this boot camp for your soul. You know, you're going without food and water. You're praying into the night. You're taking more time to understand the Quran. And you're supposed to take extra time as well to do this self-reflection on your own. But sometimes during Ramadan, it's beautifully hectic and beautifully busy, and you don't get that time. With this Ramadan, most people really appreciated how much time that they've been able to spend to do some of that extra reflection.
For Ellen Richardson, the pandemic has also had her considering the nature of worship in a new way.
What is church for? You know, who is it for? Is it for the people? Is it for the poor? Is it for God? How inclusive is our church? You know, is online more inclusive or less inclusive? All of those kinds of questions allow us to explore what it is we are called to do with this thing called church.
She's also found that, unexpectedly, these virtual services offer their own form of unexpected intimacy.
When you're in a large room or a large congregation, or maybe sitting in the back, like, you can't see people's facial expressions when they read. You can't see the pastor's facial expression when they're preaching. But when the camera is right on them, you can.
Reverend Allison Wilbur Eskildson at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Athens worries that when you take a religious service out of its communal context and stream it at home, you run the risk of consuming it like it's a piece of entertainment.
You actually even start to compare it to a Hollywood slick presentation. And if your homegrown service isn't Hollywood level of expertise, I think that over the long haul, that what worship is can be lost.
For the first time in months, several churches in Athens will hold services on Sunday. The Al Huda Islamic Center will open its doors on Friday, but ask members to bring their own prayer mats and practice social distancing. Lately, Abbas has been thinking about a piece of wisdom from the Prophet Muhammad.
People, communities are like one body. When one part of the body suffers, the entire body suffers.
For WUGA, I'm Jean Davis.
Every day, NPR's All Things Considered includes news that keeps you ahead of the curve.
If this issue is not important enough for us to draw a line in the sand, what issue is?
Plus, the unexpected.
The wing, the skin, the neck, the heart, you're making chicken meatballs, cooking the knee cartilage.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley.
And I'm Chris Shoup. Like many of our listeners, I've been spending more time working from home in the past few months. And whether your home office is an improvised recording studio or just a corner of your kitchen table, there's one nearly universal experience that almost all telecommuters are experiencing: the siren song of snacking. It's easy to snack when you're working from home, but it's not necessarily healthy. So here to help us stay healthier while teleworking is Emma Lang, Clinical Associate Professor and Director of Dietetics at the University of Georgia College of Family and Consumer Sciences. Welcome to Athens News Matters.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, working from home and sheltering in place is a significant lifestyle change for a lot of us. How is that affecting our eating habits? Like, do we tend to eat more because we have more variety and access to snacks at home as opposed to, say, a vending machine at work?
I think the reports that are coming in are pretty anecdotal that that is the case. You know, a lot of us have set up our home office at the kitchen table. So we have our snacks just a few inches away and not even just a few rooms away.
Well, in an article that you and a number of your colleagues contributed to, you really highlighted the need for flexibility and how the new demands of sheltering in place may cause us to neglect our normal eating and exercise routines. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So some of the key takeaways from that article included creating a schedule for eating that's flexible. So definitely listening to your hunger cues, meaning when you're hungry to eat. And then the other was to aim for meeting the dietary guidelines for Americans, focusing on fruits, vegetables, lean proteins, whole grains. And so when you make that the priority, you tend to feel satisfied and less likely to mindlessly snack when you can focus on adding things instead of taking them away. And then that third point was physical activity and moving around.
Well, I've heard some people say, you know, this isn't a huge deal. If we gain a few pounds now, we'll probably get back to our pre-telecommuting weight once our work lives return to normal. But that weight might still stick around for a while, right?
Yes. And what we know from the literature is that if there's a pattern of gaining weight over time, this could lead to obesity and chronic health conditions. What's hard to say, though, is that is it occasional overeating in itself that is going to lead to long-lasting detriments in health? And right. We know that there's so many factors associated with changes in our weight. So what I teach to my students and what would be important for us all to understand at this time is that simply saying that thinness equates to wellness is untrue. And so, yes, there's definitely a link. I'm not disputing that at all, that obesity is linked to chronic health conditions. But what I want to warn people about is that I don't want them taking drastic measures to try and reverse any weight gain that they might have noticed during this time without seeking the advice of a healthcare professional, a dietitian, mental health professional. So I think that that's the main message here, to be kind to ourselves and realize that overeating during times of stress that we've never experienced before is normal. And if it helps us in the short term cope with other stressors that are going on, that is okay.
Good advice. Emma Lang is a clinical associate professor and director of dietetics at the University of Georgia College of Family and Consumer Sciences. Thanks for stopping by today.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
$1.56 billion. That's how many hours of streaming content people viewed during just 1 week in mid-March as sheltering in place became widespread. And even now, as restrictions are eased, we're still consuming a lot of content. With that in mind, Gemma DiCarlo put together this short list of things that you can watch and learn from.
While there's nothing wrong with binging whole seasons of your favorite sitcom or reality show, there's also a lot of content out there right now that can help us understand the civil unrest in our country. And with the pandemic still in full swing, a lot of us have the time to do some more critical viewing. So, without further ado, here are some suggestions for your streaming queue.
Summer it is.
For the history buff, Ava DuVernay's 2014 film Selma is available on Amazon Prime. It retells the story of the three voting rights marches from Selma, Alabama to Montgomery, the first of which was met with extreme police violence on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Though Selma came out 6 years ago, and the events of the film took place over 50 years ago, its portrayals of activism, bureaucracy, and brutality are every bit as relevant today.
We now have more African Americans under criminal supervision than all the slaves back in the 1850s.
For the documentarian, another Ava DuVernay film fits the bill. Her Oscar-nominated documentary, 13th, is named for the constitutional amendment that banned slavery and involuntary servitude in the U.S., except as a punishment for criminal convictions. The movie explores how that qualification has allowed black slavery to endure in the U.S. in different disguises, from Jim Crow suppression to the war on drugs to mass incarceration. You can watch it on Netflix.
In America, I was free only in battle. Never free to rest.
Another documentary worth watching is I Am Not Your Negro, which you can rent on Amazon Prime and other streaming services.
It's inspired by James Baldwin's unfinished memoir, Remember This House, a collection of notes and letters between Baldwin and civil rights leaders like Malcolm X and Medgar Evers. It's a look at racism in America through the eyes of one of its most influential authors, narrated by the incomparable Samuel L. Jackson.
She's the queen of this here island. She's the saint of Christopher Street.
For Pride Month, consider watching Happy Birthday, Marsha on Amazon Prime or The Life and Death of Marsha P. Johnson on Netflix. Both movies concern Marsha Pay It No Mind Johnson, a black transgender activist who helped kickstart the gay rights movements of the 1970s. While Happy Birthday, Marsha focuses on her role in the Stonewall riots and The Life and Death focuses mainly on her possible murder in 1992, both movies remind us that the Pride movement was pioneered and maintained by black women, something worth celebrating this Pride Month.
Next stop, Fruitvale Station.
For the film buff, Ryan Coogler's Fruitvale Station is streaming on Tubi for free and available to rent elsewhere. Winner of a 2013 Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival and Best First Film at the Cannes Film Festival, Fruitvale depicts the last day in the life of 22-year-old Oscar Grant. He was killed by police officers in a San Francisco train station in 2009, sparking an outrage similar to today's. Coogler made the movie to give viewers the sense that they knew Oscar Grant, rather than just read about him in the paper, a sentiment as poignant now as it was then.
I don't think we should admit to something that we didn't do.
Okay, we keep fighting.
Finally, if you're looking for a TV series, director Ava DuVernay strikes again. Her four-part miniseries When They See Us, based on the Central Park jogger case of the late 1980s, debuted on Netflix just over a year ago. The series follows the five teenage suspects and their families through the boys' arrest, trial, and wrongful conviction for assault and rape. The series ends with the boys' eventual release and subsequent lawsuits against the city for wrongful conviction. This list is a start, but it's by no means comprehensive. For more suggestions, look up Strong Black Lead, a group of black Netflix executives that are amplifying content by and for people of color. For Athens News Matters, I'm Gemma DiCarlo.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
We'll be back next week. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, stay informed, and thanks for listening.